I'm going to read you a quote from Travis Walton's homepage. I looked at the vague but reassuring forms of the doctors around me. Abruptly, my vision cleared. The sudden horror of what I saw rocked me as I realized I was definitely not in a hospital. I was looking square into the face of a horrible creature with huge, luminous brown eyes the size of quarters. I looked frantically around me. There were three of them. Hysteria overcame me instantly. Travis Walton. I've not had the opportunity to meet Travis Walton, but I know some people who have. Paula Harris, one of them, and they just think he is one heck of a guy, and he's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hi, Travis. How are you?
How you doing, George?
Good. It's my pleasure to talk with you. What's new for you these days? I mean, this here's an episode that occurred almost 30 years ago. Have things changed in your life, Travis, or are you kind of back to normal again?
I try to make things as normal as possible, but sometimes they won't let me.
Totally don't. Especially talk show hosts who keep wanting to get you on their programs. Huh? Well, 30 years ago, can you believe it's been that long?
Oh, wow. It seems like yesterday in a way. You know, the aftershock is still with me, and I guess it always will be.
There are a few people, Travis, who might not have heard your story. Not a lot of them, but a few. And if you could, let's go back to that day on November 5th, 1975. If you kind of just tell us what was going on then.
Well, you know, there was seven of us, you know, headed out to work in the woods, and it was an ordinary day. And we worked that day. We were pressing the, you know, to get the contract done, so we were working some late days. But so this was another one of those days where we worked till after sundown, and we were headed out of there, and it was starting to get dark, and it's a really rough road, if you could even call it that. You know, just slow progress, slow going, because it was such a rough road. And we're making our way through the forest, and we saw a light coming through the trees. Just first, it was just a sort of a glow, and then little glimmers that you could see through the dense trees. And you know, everybody was kind of having their own little conversations going on there as we were driving along. And so, you know, I'm looking at this thing and trying to figure out what this is, because you know, it wasn't immediately, you know, evident what we were looking at, but it was something definitely out of the ordinary. This is out in the woods, you know. It was deer hunting season, and I was thinking, well, maybe some deer hunters, you know, camped out there or something. But the light seemed to be coming from above where the top of the ridge would have been. So that was kind of curious. And as we were going, getting closer to this, one by one, all these little conversations amongst the men were, you know, dropping off, and everybody started looking in the direction I was looking. So, but, you know, at first nobody said anything, but it was just, you know, something that grew on us. And could see a kind of a break in the trees where this glow was, light was coming across the road ahead. And as, you know, people started saying, well, what is that, you know? And I was thinking maybe a crashed plane or something, you know, or maybe a fire or something.
Sure.
Because it was just something that was totally out of place. But when we got around up to where this light was coming across, that was a break in the trees where we could see the source of the light, and boom, there it was. It was just the most incredible sight. It was just... He was unmistakable, you know. People say, oh, they saw some little glow of a planet off in the sky. No, this was less than 100 feet away, and we could see this object outlined against the sky there, and it was unmistakable. One of the guys in the back yelled out, it's a spaceship, or something like that line. And we stopped the truck, and it was not something that I thought very much about. It was just kind of a spur of the moment thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as the truck stopped, I threw open the door and got out. And I started towards it, because
were your buddies telling you, get back here, Travis?
Well, yeah, it kind of caught them by surprise. So I was a ways away from the truck before they, you know, got to thinking about what the heck is he doing. I was thinking that this object was only going to be visible briefly, and it was going to, you know, just take off and be gone. So I continued towards it. I was, you know, moving pretty fast when I first got out of the truck, but they started yelling at me, you know, what are you doing? When I saw the thing hadn't left, I sort of started slowing down, because, you know, I guess I have to admit I was sort of showing off for the crew.
yeah.
So I was sort of committed, and I didn't want to.
You couldn't go back.
I couldn't go back, but at the same time, I was really curious to see this thing up close, because I was, you know, still thinking it was going to take off before I got very close. But when I got up closer to it, I could hear this really strange sound it was making. Sort of a mechanical.
Like a hum?
Well, it was humming tones and a sort of a cyclic sound interwoven there. There was some extremely high-pitched sounds and also a very low rumble, you know, the kind of a rumble that you feel more than hear.
How close were you to the object at about this time, Travis?
Well, there was a pile of logging debris there, so I couldn't get right up all the way to it. You know, it was sort of partly above this pile of logging slash. It was probably, you know, 20 feet in the air, 25 feet in the air, something like that, you know.
So you were pretty close, though.
Yeah, I was pretty close. And it was giving off a really strange glow, you know, the light we were seeing through the trees when I got up closer to it, it sort of made everything look kind of odd, you know. I don't know what it was about the color of the light or whatever, but it kind of just made everything seem really very, very different up close. But those guys were getting pretty excited by this time. Later, some of them were commenting that it felt like, you know, something was about to happen. I don't know what gave him that idea, but, you know, I was, the fear was building in me, and, you know, the foolishness of what I was doing was dawning on me. At the same time, I was just, you know, really struck by what I was seeing there. Alan, one of the guys in the crew, was later interviewed, and he was saying that it looked to him like I was just drawn, you know,
mm-hmm.
like I was under some kind of compulsion. But, you know, in my mind, I was thinking all the things I've been telling you, that I was showing off for these guys and that I was, you know, curious to see this thing before it left. So that was, you know, what was in my mind, and the fear in me was growing, you know, partly, you know, because of their a growing fear and the things they were yelling at me. You know.
Did you see any shape or structure to the object, Travis, by that time?
Yeah, I could. Looking up, you know, that was just, it sort of had me really transfixed looking at this. It was so perfect, this smooth hull. It was metallic and giving off light, but at the same time it was reflecting the surrounding trees and stuff, you know. There were areas that were glowing. It wasn't so bright that I couldn't see, you know. I could still see that there was a structure to it, the edges, and it was sort of sectioned off into darker areas that made it very clear what the shape of the object was, which was like a giant disc. Like two pie pans put lip to lip, and about that time, you know, the guys were yelling, they were getting pretty excited, swearing, get the hell out of there, and I really didn't need to be told, but the sound got louder, and it started to move, and so I just instinctively jumped for cover, and there was a log sticking out of this pile of logging debris, and I jumped down behind that. And they were saying, get away from that, get the hell out of there. And I, you know, didn't really need to be told at that point because I was, you know, thinking...
You wanted to get out of there anyway.
Yeah, I was torn between staying hidden undercover there and just getting back to the truck as fast as I could. So I you know, resolved I was going to just jump up and run back to the truck. And as I raised up, I just felt this shock go through my body. It just made me go numb. You know, it's kind of a numbing shock. I don't know. You know, it's kind of like being electrocuted in a way because, you know, at the same time you're feeling this sensation come through, your ability to sense is going away. But I blacked out. The guys in the truck said that it was just like a grenade going off in front of me, that the force of this just threw me back through the air. And they said when I hit the ground, my body hit in a way that they assumed that it had killed me. And that's what they were saying to each other, get the hell out of here, we gotta go. And so they took off in the truck, and they said they dang near wrecked the truck getting out of there. Like I was saying, it's a very rough road, but they were going just as fast as they could possibly get, you know, running in the trees and stuff. And
now, were you conscious at this point, Travis, or were you knocked out?
I was unconscious.
You were out. Okay. When you finally revived, and I just read this quote from you that's on your website, is that when you realize there's something strange here? I'm in a very unusual place? Or did you remember that, you know, days later?
Well, when I first came to, it was kind of slow. I was in a lot of pain. I was in and out for quite a long time. But, you know, you read the quote about when I finally cleared my vision. That was a little farther along because I was thinking what had happened to me, and I was thinking back, and I assumed that I'd been hurt and taken to a hospital. And so I remembered the incident, you know, up to the point of, you know, being hit, but, you know, thinking that that these sounds around, moving around me was were doctors. But when I finally could see, I saw these creatures looking at me, and I just flipped out. It just...
Did you think you were dreaming at that point?
Well, you know, there's, in looking back at the whole thing, you know, you're always doing this reality checking in your head. You know, this is so incredible. You're trying to, you know, get your mind around it. You know, you could this be? You know, but it was real in every way. The solidness of the objects and whatnot. You know,
describe for us, Travis, the aliens themselves, the extraterrestrials.
Well, they were a lot smaller than I was. Short, you know, less than 5 feet, you know, four something maybe. They were humanoid, you know, the two arms, two legs, and like that. But they had the most, you know, striking feature with these eyes. They were just looking at me, looking through me, is the way it felt. It just seemed like they could see everything I was thinking and feeling, and it was a very, very uncomfortable feeling. It was,
were these the classic grays, or what color were they?
Well, they were sort of a chalky white. I don't know if, you know, this is 1975. It wasn't that common of a report, but I think there are differences from what people call the classic grays, because I was actually able to see them blink at one point. So, you know, they did have eyelids.
Did they have hair on their heads?
They were bald, a very large cranium area of the head. Their heads were bald. And they were coming towards me, and I don't know what their intentions were, but I felt very, very threatened, and I was just lashing out at them to try to keep them away from me, just screaming all kinds of things because I was totally, you know, losing it.
At any point did you feel threatened? I mean, really seriously threatened by them?
Oh, yeah. You know, when I first regained consciousness, I perceived this whole situation as just as maximally threatening as you could possibly get, you know. Now, whether or not that's the way it actually was, you know, in hindsight, I can go back and analyze the situation. But at that point, you know, I just felt this incredible fear. A lot of that may have had to do with the fact that I couldn't breathe. I don't know whether that was due to the effects of being hit by this beam of energy,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, that there may have been some sort of, you know, harm done to me that I hadn't recovered from, or maybe the atmosphere in there wasn't, you know, quite what I should be breathing. But I felt like I just couldn't catch my breath, like I was, you know, couldn't breathe enough, sort of a suffocating feeling, which is a very panicky thing, you know, probably just the most panicky sort of sensation a person can have. You combine that with seeing these things all at once, with this pain I was feeling in my head and chest, and all of that just combined to make the situation seem extremely threatening. When, you know, they weren't like swinging weapons at me or anything like that. It was just, I was trapped. This place was dimly lit and very small and tight. It was claustrophobic, the suffocating feeling, all of that just combined to make the feeling just so, you know, panic, just total panic.
Did you witness any other humans there at the time, Travis?
No, I didn't. At one point in my efforts to find a way out, what I took to be a human being came in, and you know, I thought I was rescued. That this was some sort of intervention by, you know, Air Force or something like that. Turned out not to be the case, or at least that's what I think now. But you know, this individual led me out of this craft, took me out of the craft. Which at that point was parked inside of this large room, or it was either a building or a larger craft. As far as, you know, things that were done in the movie with you know, other humans or dead people or anything like that, then none of that happened.
Where did they drop you back off at?
Well, when I regained consciousness, I just came to pretty quickly there, it was kind of like the cold air, and I found myself lying on face down on the edge of the highway, and I looked up to see where this light was coming from. There was a glow coming from above me, and I looked up and just as it went off, and I could see this craft hovering above the roads just for an instant before it shot up into the sky.
All right, stay with us. Travis Walton, our guest. When we come back, we'll ask him how long he was wandering around after they dropped him off, because authorities were searching for him. As a matter of fact, they believed that his friends, the other group of loggers, may have killed him. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with our guest Travis Walton, Fire in the Sky on Coast to Coast AM. Travis, were you taken for 5 days and then dropped off, or did it take them 5 days to finally find you?
I was taken for 5 days, but I didn't know it at the time. When I regained consciousness, I looked around, and I recognized this stretch of road, and I could see the lights of the town down below, and the memory of, you know, the terror that I had just experienced, you know, just gave me my last little shot of energy as I ran down into the town to get help, get back to, you know, people that I knew in a more comforting situation. But I was able, with my last ounce of strength, to make a phone call. You didn't even have to have a coin to talk to the operator in this part of the country.
You just pick it up and they show up, huh?
No, first, there was a row of phone booths there, and I went into, and the first one was out of order. You know, I was at the end of my rope. I was just in a total panic, and here the phone wouldn't work. But I went into the next one, and it got, I got it to work before I collapsed, where my family came and got me. But when they were driving me back to the town I lived in, see, well, I was dropped off outside the town nearest where this happened, which is still up in the forest, and then there was another, you know, 30 miles back to the town where the crew lived. But it was on that trip back that they were saying things that didn't quite jive to me, because I thought this was still the same night. But they said, "Travis, feel your face." And I reached up and I had this growth of beard that just didn't, you know, jive. And I looked at my watch and the date had changed by, you know,
five days.
Well, actually, you know, I neglected to reset it. It was just one of those ones that went around 31 to 31. But
yeah.
But anyway, I knew days had gone by, and it was just a huge shock to me. Where was I? What are they doing with me? And so I had been trying to get it out, you know, talk about what had happened, but every time, you know, I came back to that memory in such detail as to describe it, I just broke down, and it was pretty rough. I was in pretty bad shape, so they didn't push on that anymore, and I was unable to really get more out at that time. But
and unbeknownst to you at that time, Travis, police think you've been killed, right?
Yeah, there was this massive search going on afterwards. The men came into town. They didn't know what to do. They were, you know, at first they tried to get help from some deer hunters, and thinking that they could get, you know, some people with rifles and go back, and because they were pretty scared to return. You know, in the movie they have you know, Mike getting upset at the guys, "We got to go back," and those guys refusing, and finally telling them to get out, and he's going back, and went back by himself. But in reality, those guys weren't about to stand out there on the road in the dark, and they did all go back together that same night, and they, you know, found that the craft was gone. They were pretty scared, you know, I got to hand it to them that they, you know, were able to overcome that to try to see if they could, you know, rescue me if that were possible.
Sure.
You know, a lot of them were convinced I was killed and they should just go on into town, but they did go check and make a search, and when they couldn't find anything, they went back into town, and they were arguing whether to tell the authorities or just get some family and friends and go back out and make their own search. But they finally decided to, you know, call the authorities, and they called a local deputy, and he called the sheriff. The sheriff came down, and he was, you know, had many years in law enforcement, and he knew something really heavy duty had happened. He could, you know, some of the men were still crying, and they were so shook up that he knew something really bad had gone down.
Mm-hmm.
But unbeknownst to the men, the law enforcement people were suspecting that there had been some kind of a fight, and these guys had killed me, maybe, you know, unintentionally. But they were probably trying to cover it up and were making up this story to, you know, explain why I was no longer around. So They had this massive search. They had men on horseback, the search and rescue team, they had Forest Service people, volunteers, people on horseback, they had tracking dogs, aircraft crisscrossing the area. It went on for quite a while, but the pressure was growing because of the suspicion that these guys had murdered me. And so, you know, they're saying, "We're telling the truth," and, you know, they volunteered to take lie detector tests.
And prior to you showing up, Travis, had they conducted lie detector tests on them at that time?
Yeah, they had. A few days after the incident, they had gone down to the county seat and taken polygraph tests.
And they all passed?
Yeah, they passed them.
Okay, so now you show up on the scene. It's got to be a pandemonium. They've got to be in shock. There you are.
No, it was a madhouse in this town. You know, there were, it was this a very small town, and, you know, we, we didn't even have a single stoplight at the time, you know, population 3,000 or 4,000 or something, but it was, you know, reporters from Japan and Australia, and it was just crazy around here, you know, people pressuring the family and law enforcement and all this stuff going on. So when I was returned, the family had already had a crash course in the situation. There had been some people who had called the family, you know, and there was this one lady who was a nurse. She said she had been working in a hospital where an elderly couple had come in reporting this kind of thing, and the next day she comes back on shift, and the couple was gone, and their records were gone, and she asked where they are, and they were acting like, you know, what couple, you know? So she was warning the family about just be careful, you know, if he should be returned, because you don't know what's going to happen to him. This couple disappeared. And another person called the family, he said he was retired CIA and made similar warnings. So when I was returned, this was in the middle of the night, and the family, you know, looked at my condition and said, there is no way we're going to turn Travis over to this mob, you know.
No, you were probably near a breakdown, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I was hanging by a thread. And so...
And how old were you, Travis, in 75?
I was 22 at the time.
Okay. You're just a kid. Yeah. That's young. All right.
Yeah. And so my brother took me off to Phoenix, which is where he lived. He'd come up just on hearing what had happened and was involved in the search and everything. And so he took me down there and went to try to find some medical help to, you know, make sure I was okay. And so it was some touch and go trying to get a hold of some people that would, you know, provide the tests in a, you know, anonymous way without drawing attention. You know, even in the big city of Phoenix, it was still so crazy that when I was taken to Barrow's Neurological Institute for some tests under an assumed name, there was people in the parking lot, there he is, you know, and Jason is back to the car, and we go driving off, and these, you know, it was just crazy, the pressure, you know, and you know, the phone ringing constantly, even there, where is he, and you know, my brother was just trying to throw him off the scent, telling him, oh, he's not here, he's in a hospital in Tucson. But people from the Aerophenomena Research Organization, at that time the oldest and largest
UFO organization,
it managed to, you know, get a hold of my brother and convince him that they, you know, could manage these sorts of tests in a professional way that wouldn't attract a mob. And so, you know, we started cooperating with them, and they ran a whole lot of tests. I had blood and urine samples run through the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's drug screen, because there was all sorts of speculation in the media. After the murder theory didn't pan out, you know, I was still alive, they started trying to say, well, you know, these guys are out, you know, drinking or doing drugs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sheriff was specifically asked about that, and he said, you know, I sat in their truck after this happened, and I was looking for signs of that. And of course, you know, in the course of his many years in law enforcement, he knew what he was looking for, and he said he didn't see any sign of that. But nevertheless, these kinds of, you know, people were desperate to explain it away any way they could. And so, you know, in order to answer those questions, these tests were run. They showed no trace of any drug in my body. I had body x-rays, battery medical tests, psychiatric examination. There was also the theory that I had experienced a transitory psychosis, that I, you know, had just had this mental breakdown and imagined the whole thing. But you know what these theories about psychosis and drug hallucination, all that kind of stuff, you know, never took into account is how do these seven men all have the same hallucination? You know?
Exactly, and all pass lie detector tests.
Yeah, and so you know, it was just one thing after another, and I kind of, you know, withdrew for a while, which led to even more speculation.
Travis, did law enforcement ever get to a point, even today, where they finally agree with you and the other loggers what happened out there that day in 1975?
Well, you know, back at the time, the sheriff was in a very difficult position. You know, he was an elected official, and the community was split down the middle over this, and there was a lot of back and forth amongst people. You know, it would have been simple if everybody had been disbelieving, but the truth was, you know, half the people did believe it, and so there was a lot of pressure on him to satisfy everybody. So he was very middle of the road, and although, you know, people that he met with and associated with privately said that, you know, they felt that he did believe that, you know, something had happened there. But there have been other people that were in law enforcement at the time, and I've been contacted here and there over the years by a variety of people in law enforcement, and you know, there is quite a bit of acceptance out there, and these are people who have looked at the evidence. Unfortunately, you know, many people wanted to make up their mind, and evidence be damned. They didn't care about the fact.
Sure.
They didn't even have the information, and yet they're drawing conclusions about it. So that was a big disappointment to me, that, you know, sometimes people were drawing conclusions when they didn't have the facts.
So were any charges levied against anybody, or they just simply said, you know what, nothing happened, there's no crime committed, everybody's free and clear?
Well, you know, the men were off the hook as far as murder was concerned, but there were efforts by certain skeptics to try to get the county sheriff to file charges, but they had a press conference and said, you know, this is just a collection of unsubstantiated theories, and there's, you know, no evidence to base any sort of charges on, and we're not going to do that. So,
how did then I want to talk with you a little bit later, probably next hour, about the movie Fire in the Sky, how it relates to your real story, and then get your views, Travis, on what you think happened to you and why. But how did the media begin to pick up on a national basis the fact that there was this Travis Walton story? Was it picked up almost immediately around 1975, or did that happen years later?
Oh, well, yeah, it was immediate. You know, like I was saying, this town was just overrun with international reporters, and it was just crazy, you know. And that one of the polygraph tests that I was scheduled to appear for, I didn't appear for, because it was just, it was supposed to be done in secret, and we're getting ready to leave for the test, and they're on the TV, they're talking about, and then Travis Walton's going to be here, and there was just all these reporters all over the place. They were set up on the buildings across the street, you know. That it was just a crazy madhouse, and so that was a broken promise about confidentiality in a low-key situation. But it was out of my hands. There were accusations. Oh, this is, you know, he's grabbing for publicity or something. Man, I was hiding out. I was doing my best to stay out of the media. But it was an international, worldwide story before I was ever returned. And so I was in a situation more of, you know, defending myself against accusations and responding to requests. And you know, I never sought out an interview in my life.
Is it accurate to call these extraterrestrials your abductors, or could we just say they were merely testing you?
Point, because, you know, it's been, you know, just called an abduction right off the bat. But, you know, what if there was a scenario there that this beam hitting me was an accident of some sort, and that they intervened for another reason, and they didn't really ever intend to take me, but my unexpected approach, getting too close like that, is what caused all this. So, you know, you bring up a good point there, that, you know, maybe it wasn't like a planned abduction at all. And it's really kind of what the theory that I prefer, because, you know, it's just something that happened because of my own foolish actions, and and isn't likely to repeat itself.
Maybe the beam killed you for some reason. You got too close and some mechanism on the craft just automatically wiped you out, and they realized, we got to save this poor guy.
Yeah, that was one speculation I had in the book, and you know, and that they may have felt obligated to, you know, to fix this, being probably the only people who could, you know what to do in that situation. And maybe it was just reviving me, you know.
Did they ever communicate with you?
No. You know, people say, well, you know, I could hear the sounds of movement, the, you know, things I was throwing and the sounds of, you know, that kind of stuff, my own screams. So, you know, it wasn't like I had my hearing damaged by being hit by this thing. It's just that I did not hear them make any sounds. And so people ask me, well, did you get any sort of a psychic impression or anything? But I'll tell you, I was definitely not in a receptive state. You know,
I don't
my mind
blame
was just a frantic, screaming mess of, you know, so I didn't get anything that way either. So it was pretty, I think that really added to my panic, is the fact that I wasn't getting any answers or response from either these humanoids or these more human-looking individuals.
Would you go today, Travis, if this craft came back and they, I guess with telepathy, basically communicated with you, would you willingly go back into that craft?
No, I wouldn't. You know, I if I had it to do over again, I'd stay in that truck. You know, what a fateful decision. It, you know, it's done so much to my life that I would rather had never happened. I've learned a lot from this. I've learned a lot about people and their reaction to things of this sort, and it's given me an insight about things that I never would have had. But, you know, on a daily, day-to-day basis for me and my family, you know, it's been a net negative, and I wished it never happened.
You wish it never happened, but it did, and of course it affected you. Have you beaten yourself up over these years trying to figure out where they might have come from?
Well, I used to really, you know, just rack my head about, you know, what this meant, what was the intention, was it good, bad, and, you know, early on I realized I was never going to, I did not have enough to go on. I was never going to be able to resolve these things with what I had, and I was just going to have to leave things as it was. You know.
Stay with us. Travis Walton, when we come right back, we'll talk about the movie Fire in the Sky, compare it to his story, his book, Fire in the Sky. And then, of course, we'll talk about the future. Just why are we being visited? If we are being visited, what do they want? And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Travis Walton. His website, by the way, is TravisWalton, WALTON.com. Linked up with his name at CoastToCoastAM.com, and wrote the book called Fire in the Sky. Travis, the movie, 1993, the book Fire in the Sky, your real life story. Hollywood loves to portray things in its own little way. Did they do the same thing with the movie?
Yeah, they sure did. And, you know, I turned down so many offers over the years because I was afraid of exactly that kind of changes, fictionalization and that sort of thing. But I guess, I've got to console myself with the idea that, you know, a lot of the things that were changed to succeed in symbolizing the way things really were.
Well, and eventually, you know, you had to acquiesce and say, okay, let's do the story. They gave you a bit part in it, too.
Oh, no. Well, see, what happened was, you know, once I signed away my rights, I had no legal ability to affect anything from that point on.
Ah.
And for a long time, and, you know, as the script developed with the scriptwriter, it was much, you know, truer to the original incident. It was only after the studio and other producers got involved that the pressure came on to change things. And that was when I was starting to be kept out of the loop. And so, you know, like I said, I was powerless. And when I got wind of some of these things, I wrote letters to try to get them to not do some of these things. Some of that was partially successful, but basically they're a bunch of creative people, and they want to be creative.
They did what they have to do. What were some of the issues that you wanted to change in the movie?
Well, you know, changes that to me, you know, affected the experience itself. The script that I was provided with had the sequence aboard the craft completely omitted, so I had no inkling how far off that was going to get. But, you know, some of the other changes I was gradually persuaded were, you know, for the best. It was much easier to tell a story that didn't have so many characters. It just takes up a lot of screen time to introduce people and have you understand who they are. So the crew number was reduced, and that was just to simplify the telling. I had two brothers involved in the story, Don and Dwayne, and they were reduced to one named Dan. And, you know, that worked for the part of the story that they were telling. You know, in my book, I go into great detail and the differences between the way that my two brothers reacted. But basically, you know, the one role fulfilled that. And, you know, the skeptical point of view was put into this character, Sheriff Waters, that was really a combination of a number of people, a number of the lawmen, and sort of a voice for the, you know, the suspicioning investigator.
What did you think of the way they portrayed the inside of the craft and the aliens?
Oh, well, that, you know, was just totally, you know, missed it for me. You know, their reasoning was that there were beer commercials out with this sort of thing. You know, this was so many years after the original incidents, 15, 16 years, and what was extremely unusual at the time it happened had become more commonplace in American culture, and they were just, you know, afraid of showing something that the people had seen before. But, you know, I've gotten hundreds of emails over the years from people who say that they wish the story had been as it was, and I can't think of a single person who thought that the changes were an improvement.
And again, James Garner played Lieutenant Waters in the movie. Was that pretty lifelike, his character?
Yeah. Like I said, if you consider him to be several lawmen rolled into one, there was the town marshal here, and then there was the county sheriff and several deputies involved, and even some skeptical investigators outside of the area whose, you know, voice were all rolled into James Garner's character. And that gave, you know, a focus for that particular end of it. Personally, you know, I wish they had stayed with the real story. And there was even a group of people who were, you know, trying to get the studio to sell them the rights to the movie and reshoot the end and do it the way it really happened. But apparently that wasn't financially feasible, at least not yet.
How did you like the portrayal of you by D.B. Sweeney?
I think he did a great job. You know, of course, you know, I had a lot of misgivings, especially when in the early days of the casting, you know, when they were picking various people. I thought, oh, I hope it's not going to be him. you know, they were well-known actors, but still people I didn't feel really represented the kind of person I was. I think... you know, each actor had their own approach to it. The guy who played Mike Rogers, he wanted to meet Mike and know as much about him and me as possible. DB's take was to not meet us so that he wouldn't be affected by, you know, he was scared. Well, what if I didn't believe him? You know, then how would I be able to, you know, portray this, you know, the reality of this? But, you know, he said that after he'd met us, you know, that turned out not to be a problem, but at the time going into it, he was afraid meeting us would be something that wouldn't help him, you know, do his job. So,
Travis, if I remember, when they found you in the movie, you were like cowering in the corner of a phone booth, and you didn't have any clothes on. That did not happen for real, did it?
No, I was you know, slumped in the phone booth, all right, and I was in terrible, you know, state of breakdown, but. The nude thing was just, you know, Hollywood trying to... You should have seen what they had planned. They even shot some stuff that didn't get used, fortunately. But I guess every movie's got to have its nude scene, they think.
Yeah, even with aliens, right?
Yeah.
As you look back today, 30-some years later? And of course, your case, there are two cases that I think of alien intervention are the best I've ever seen since I was a kid following these things, too. The Barney and Betty Hill case, and then your case. There are none others like this. I mean, all the others are just miles behind both of you. And now, of course, with Barney Hill gone, Betty Hill has deceased, this leaves just you. I mean, you're out there all by yourself. Paula Harris, who does some research work for us on UFO cases, just thinks the world of you. We even had a picture of you and her posted on the website a couple months ago when she had come back from Italy. And you've got a lot of respect in this field, which I think is very important.
Well, you know, there's some good investigators, and there's some that aren't so good, you know, and there's a lot of cases that I people ask me about other cases, and I've always hesitated to comment on other cases because, you know, in my book, I quote Emerson, I say, condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance, you know. And all I was asking people was to just take a look at the facts before you draw a conclusion. And the book was, you know, designed to, you know, put as many of those facts as I could before people for their own judgment. But, there was, you know, too many people who were, you know, even investigators who were drawing conclusions without information. So, you know, Paul Harris is a great investigator, and there are a lot of others who've, you know, been extremely, you know, made great contributions to the investigating my case and to the field in general. But
I'm curious, Travis, could you tell if these entities, this is a biological question, were male, female, or did they all look the same?
I could not tell gender amongst those three. Not aliens, you know, they just, I couldn't tell.
I would assume you have no idea where they came from.
No, I don't, you know, and I, you know, we refer to them as aliens, but I don't know. You know, all I know is what I experienced and, you know, whether they're from another dimension or, you know, where, you know, I don't know. And all I try to stick to in the book as much as possible is to say, you know, what I experienced and try not to speculate too much about anything beyond that. There are speculations, but I label them as speculation.
True. What do you think they wanted with you and so many other people, I assume?
Well, you know, a lot of people say, well, look, they had their eye on you from the start, and they're not finished with you. You know, I don't like that idea. So, you know, I favor the theory that I just did the wrong thing, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it led to things that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So, you know, that way I get on with my life and try to get back to normal, you know, as best I can.
Because it doesn't seem like they sought you out. It sounds like as you were moving your way toward the craft, something happened. But I'm not so sure if you had stayed in the truck that this thing would have gone after you and the other members of the logging group.
Yeah, that's why I say I wish I'd have stayed in the truck and we'd have just, you know, shot out of there. But who knows what would have happened, you know. It's just, again, we're into speculation. I know what did happen, and I stand by that, and so do all of the others, and investigators have confirmed. You know, I tried to document everything in the book and deal with as many of the charges that were made against us as possible, but you know, some of the dumbest things still come up. You know, here I had the polygraph evidence reviewed by the top experts in the world, people who have testified before Congress, who have trained the CIA, the FBI, you know, the top men in the profession, and some guy comes along and says, "Well, I don't believe it because I talked to a deputy sheriff from San Bernardino who doesn't think that the test was valid." You know, what does he know? It's just totally absurd. You know, you go to all this extent to document things and get the best experts, and a so-called investigator can say something like that. It's just out of this world, you know.
Now, did any of your recall come from hypnosis, or was this all straight from your own memory?
Well, you know, I remembered the incident, but it was kind of like this, you know, full of this hysteria that was just this images of, you know, so filled with fear. When I did undergo the hypnosis, I recalled everything that I recalled before, but without the fear. And that was the way the session was designed, was to finally let me say these things without this hysteria that just, you know, I'd break down before I could finish. And so it didn't supply any extra details, but at the same time, there's this period of, you know, 5 days and 6 hours. The conscious period I had was brief, you know, just a matter of minutes or hours, you know, less than an hour probably, I don't know. You know, when you're in a hysterical state, it's hard to judge time, but, you know.
Did you lose any weight during that five-day period?
Yeah, there was a weight loss, and that was recorded both on the home scales that night and confirmed in the doctor's office in the next day or two that there was a weight loss, but I regained the weight rather quickly, so they assumed that much of that was dehydration.
They probably didn't give you much water, maybe just a little bit to keep you alive.
Yeah, you know, and whether I was fed or not, I don't remember eating, so, you know, I don't know how my body survived that period of time, because, you know, I didn't have any memory of it. There's a question of whether there was some more memories that are not recovered, you know, or just a period of time at which I was comatose or unconscious, or, you know, some people think even dead, you know, but I don't know. It's something I haven't wanted to dig into. It's just, here we are 30 years later, and it's like a can of worms that I'm afraid to look into, you know.
What do you think of other people now, Travis, who say that they feel as if they've had similar experiences?
Well, you know, I think that there are people who have had some genuinely very real experiences, you know, and others that it's mostly real to them. And I don't think that this is quite as common as some people think, you know, to where it's on the verge of almost everybody has been abducted or something. I really doubt that, but, you know, that's just my opinion. Like I said, I haven't investigated all these cases, but my personal impression is that it's a lot more rare than people think, and there's two very, very big phenomena here, that, you know, the kind of thing that I experienced, and a sort of a psychosocial phenomenon that is, you know, interesting, to say the least, you know, in terms of its impact on human society, but at the same time, it's an entirely different category than what I went through.
Do you think government is holding back, that they're just not disclosing this whole phenomena?
Well, it's my opinion again, but I think definitely that they know a heck of a lot more than they're letting on, and that they have some very, very powerful reasons to not want to come forward and say what they know.
And do you think if we were told what's really going on, we'd panic?
Some people would, but, you know, it may have more to do with other things that the government's in fear of, and it has to do with just their power and people's, you know, trust in them, rather than, you know, the way we would react to it.
I've always wondered, Travis, that if the populace really believed we were being visited and had been visited, and finally the government told them the truth, I would wonder if there would be this widespread panic, or if there'd be this acceptance, or if there would be this reluctance to pay taxes and things like that, with people saying, you know, there's more to this life than just here.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and you're right that, you know, some of these sorts of things that would follow are unpredictable, and the government doesn't like that sort of thing. But I think there's a deeper reason, a more central reason, central to the power structure. Just for instance, if they had technology, knew that technology existed that would make oil not important,
obsolete.
That's the you know, lifeblood of power on this planet, and they wouldn't like that disrupted, you know, and just that alone could be enough to just keep quiet about what they knew. But, you know, I've had several personal experiences that lead me to think that the government, you know, has more knowledge. And one of them is this federal investigator that came into this case and tried to extort confessions. And there was an implied threat about just shut up kind of thing. And then some intrigue that happened shortly after the release of the movie. This guy came forward, said that he was in military intelligence and that he was in the area at the time it happened, and that he witnessed the incident from a nearby ridge. And this is rugged backcountry, and I was struck by the fact that this guy knew the topography of the terrain of that area. He said he was deer hunting at the time, and that he'd gone to his superiors in military intelligence and asked them if he should come forward and say what he'd seen, and he was told to keep quiet unless the men were going to be convicted of murder, which turned out not to be the case. So he you know, decided not to come forward, but he sounded legit. And he said his wife was with him and could verify a lot of things. And so I told the people at Paramount about this, and I was involved in the promotion of the movie at the time, and that was the last I thought about it. But unbeknownst to me, when we went off to be on the Larry King show, Paramount had flown this guy out to California and interviewed him, and something aroused their suspicion, so they tested him, and the results were very peculiar.
Did he pass?
He passed the part about being in military intelligence and witnessing the incident. He flunked the part about having connections with some of the major skeptics that had been attacking this case, which is a very... I mean, these are opposite polar reactions on the test questions.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that when we come right back, Travis. That is fascinating and much more. And welcome back, Travis Walton. I guess Travis, very interested in this intervention, whatever it could be. So the testing was very peculiar with this individual.
Yeah, apparently, you know, the plan was to insinuate himself in as a witness and then somehow discredit it. But I don't know. You know, he was given some stern warnings by the people at Paramount and hasn't reappeared. But there was some very, very funny stuff going on there. He scored near the very highest points on his polygraph test. That was scored by both the examiner and the computer as near the highest level of believability as far as military intelligence, as far as witnessing the incident, but then near the bottom when it come to his possible communication with some of the major skeptics in this case. So that was something that I never did get really fully to the bottom of, but there was a lot of other intrigue, disappearing files. The police reports were, you know, we were entitled to that, and we went looking for them on behalf of the studio. And they said, sure, come back tomorrow, and we'll have them for you. And then they said, sorry, they're not there.
They're gone, huh?
Yeah, well, fortunately, the sheriff, who's an honest man, he had copies of much of that material in his home files, and we were able to get copies of it that way. But where that stuff went, the old APRO file, which I'm told was over a foot thick, has vanished. And
shame.
A lot of funny goings on here and there.
Travis, since that time then, in that time period, after the movie, let's say, have you been approached by government to date?
Well, no one, like I said about this federal criminal investigator came in and tried to extort a... He went down and looked at the police file, and we know that he was involved in that. No one that came to me and said, I'm from the government and here's, I'm looking into this incident. But I'm certain they were looking into things and trying to, you know, affect some of this to some extent. There was another really odd incident that came out. We were doing shows for the promotion of the movie, and Paramount had us do an interview. Well, it wasn't Paramount. It was Hard Copy, I guess, or another show like that. We went out to the site, and it was the middle of winter, but because of the time, you know, so much snow that they rented big snowcats to get back in there. But in spite of the snow, it was still very hard to locate the spot. We hadn't been back there in years because everything looked different. Well, I found out later that, you know, Mike went back out there. This is the crew boss, that was there at the incident, had decided there was something very odd about that. And what had happened was that these trees at the site were very much bigger than we thought they ought to be. Hmm. And so he took some core samples, and it was very revealing that we saw growth rings that were, you know, just very, very thin, you know, 16th of an inch, leading up to 1975. And at the time of the core sample was taken, 15, 16 years, that in that intervening time, the trees had grown an increase in volume of 36 times the amount of wood fiber that they had been producing, you know, per year in all the years before that. And I've got pictures of that in the book, that these growth rings just suddenly became many times thicker at that point on. And it's very easy to clock this right back to the very date that the incident happened.
Well, they get a burst of extraterrestrial fertilizer or something like
Whatever happened there, it affected the trees in the immediate area where the craft came down, and the effect diminishes as you get farther away from it.
So you are about 52 now. What is Travis Walton doing now?
Well, I'm just working at a paper recycling plant as a quality control person, and just trying to get on with my life and live as normal as possible. But people don't forget, and sometimes I forget that they're thinking about things that I wish they weren't. Looking at me, if you're looking for something strange, you're going to find it. But, you know, I tell you, I'm one of the most ordinary people there is. But
when they meet you, or when people hear your name, do they quickly realize who you are?
I get that. You know, even in other cities, you know, to some extent. But something I try to avoid.
What has been in your career, Travis? Think back for a moment. Maybe one of the best meetings with an individual who just wanted to meet you or ask you a question of what happened. I mean, is there any one thing that comes to mind, one person that just affected you in such a way where, you know, you realize, hey, this person understands what happened to me, or something like that?
Well, you know, the truth is there's been a lot of people like that, and too many to you know, single anybody out, but you know, there's also been the other kind, people that I feel, you know, are not on the same wavelength at all. So it's kind of a mixed bag that way.
Does it still bother you, those people?
I think a lot of that, what they call the lunatic fringe, it really kind of muddies the water and prevents legitimate scientists from taking a look at this because of fear, ridicule, and the whole air of the absurd that surrounds that kind of thing. You know, they're not helping, and by association, I get painted as being somebody that's wacko, and that's not the case. Like I said, I had a whole battery of psychiatric examinations, a perfectly normal pattern of scores. I'm a really down-to-earth person, and people who know me, you know, feel very strongly that that's the case. I think the closer someone is to me, the more likely they are to support the case and believe that this is all something that really happened. So.
Did you ever stay close with the other loggers who were with you on that day?
No, actually, you know, we weren't a bunch of buddies. We were a group of men that were together for the purpose of running a living, and we were there for the job. And once the job fell apart because of this incident, that everybody went their separate ways. And I've seen a few of them, you know, from time to time, and some not really, you know, much after that period of time back then.
Do they not want anything to do with you? I mean, does this bring back good or bad memories for them?
I think, you know, some of them are just content to just let it lie. You know, so, like, you know, some of the younger guys, like Steve, he really doesn't want to talk about it. He, you know, it's just something he doesn't let people talk to him about, and he's refused interviews. He just has stayed away. And a lot, everybody, you know, basically tried to just get on with their life, but to a man, they all stand by what we experienced. And
well, and you know, for the rest of your life, this will always be part of your life. You just, even if you wanted to get away from it, you could not.
Yeah, as much as I wish I could, you know, I go through little mental scenarios how I could remove that from my life, and there doesn't seem to be a way, but so it's going to be there.
Of all the things that occurred to you after this happened to you, if you could change one thing besides the fact that you got in the truck and took off, what would that have been?
You know, during the experience, if I had, you know, kept my cool better, you know, if I could have been more rational and somehow got a response and got some questions answered, you know, that would have helped. You know, even if I never made them public, it's things that if I could know and have some answers.
You think maybe you should have been a little more aggressive with whatever these entities were?
Well, or maybe a little more controlled. Maybe just the fact that I was out of control in a very panic, hysterical way was the main obstacle to getting more information, more of a response about what are you doing with me? What does this mean?
You're a human being, and you know, and that's a normal experience that you went through. I don't know what I would do if that happened to me. On one hand, I wish I had a tape recorder with me so I could put it on this program. On the other hand, I think I'd be freaking out.
I think a lot of people who think they would remain calm and ask good questions would respond in a very similar way. You know, as for the crewmen, I think that, you know, they received a lot of criticism, especially from my family, for having panicked and left. But, you know, I think that the extent that they returned and tried to rescue me, they were heroes, and that shouldn't be forgotten. That a lot of bad feelings came out over, you know, that their panicked departure, but you know they did the best they could, and they went through a traumatic experience themselves.
You mentioned the craft was saucer shaped. How big was it?
Well, it was big in the sense of, you know, it was a very imposing sight in the woods, but it was smaller than I would think it should be. It was like 20, 25 feet in diameter, but when I came out of this craft, I don't know, maybe this was a different craft. It seemed so much bigger, but I had a physical building to compare it to at that time.
Maybe they took you up to a bigger ship, a mothership.
Yeah, or to a building somewhere, you know. It could have been a part of a ship, or it could have been a building. I couldn't tell. I couldn't see out, and I never felt any movement or anything, but there are a lot of unanswered questions about that.
Okay, so we look at these various entities that we've all been told about. The grays, you said that these looked a little whitewashed with eyes about the size of quarters, no hair. Did you see any? You just saw three, right? You didn't see any so-called Nordics or reptilians?
Well, yes. Like I said, you know, this human person that got me out of there, I saw, you know, four of them, they would pass in a crowd, you know.
Okay, so they would be the classic Nordics, and
yeah.
Okay, so they weren't humans there to help you. You think they were also wherever they may be?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking now. You know, at the time I thought these are human beings that, you know, but I was very, you know, alarmed by the fact that I wasn't getting any verbal response. I could definitely tell gender there. There was one female, but there was no verbal response. There was some changes in expression, just slight, but basically they were just not going to help me out. And that would have helped tremendously, you know, as far as, you know, calming down, just to hear a voice.
I wonder if they were the true extraterrestrials, and that the so-called bald-headed whitewashed things were like robots or something.
Yeah, that's possible. You know, with high enough technology, you could have a being that would appear to be an organic being that could be mechanical. That was one thing I speculated about.
Travis, these tests that were conducted on you after the fact when you came back, did they corroborate anything? Did they say something has happened to you? We can tell, we can see an incision, anything like that?
Well, there was a puncture mark on my arm, and, you know, this just fueled the speculation about drugs, but, you know, there were no traces of any drug in my body of any kind. And we work in around a lot of brush, you know, and there's a lot of thorny brush that it's got a very tough stalk, and when the chain hits that, rather than cutting it, it just drags it back at you and slaps you with those thorns, and you can get poked that way. So, you know, that may have been what that was, especially since the doctor said it was not over any major blood vessel, which rules out the idea that there was some sort of intravenous injection or anything like that.
Do you recall seeing anything inside the craft that looked unusual?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of instruments there that really gave me the creeps because I didn't know what they had been doing with them, you know, while I was unconscious, or what they had intended to do when I regained consciousness. But nothing I really recognized, you know. Sort of like surgical instruments, but, you know, I probably wouldn't even recognize surgical instruments at the time.
Here's a message from Brenda in Woodland Hills. Wanted to know what these human-like beings were wearing, if you could remember.
Well, they had a blue uniform. It was a tight-fitting blue uniform, but no insignia, no weapons.
Did this event change your perception of God or the universe or anything like that?
No. You know, that's pretty much remained unchanged. I was a pretty philosophical person before, and I think that this incident really intensified that. It's been kind of my life, you know, ever since, trying to make sense of everything.
Though you admit that you're not sure where these entities came from.
No.
Do you believe there is life out there in the universe beyond ours?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I don't know that they came from there, but I was just watching a documentary the other night where they were saying now astronomers are thinking probably most planets, the stars have planets going around them, you know. So you look out and you see those billions that are visible from Earth, and, you know, it would be absurd to think that this was the only Earth-like one amongst them.
I think we've been visited for a long, long time.
Yeah, well, you know, the universe is so old. You know, they've had a long time to know things we don't know.
You know,
there's people who can sit there and make pronouncements of the limitations on their ability to go from there to here, but I think that's a little bit arrogant, to say the least.
Do you ever have nightmares anymore, Travis?
Not so much anymore. I've got a handle on that. It was pretty bad in the early years, and then, you know, when the movie came up, I started thinking and talking about it a lot more, so I had some more dreams come back at me there. You know, people were asking me, well, could this have been repressed memories coming to the surface? But, you know, some seemed like a dream to me, but not a happy dream.
When you go out, do people leave you alone?
Generally, you know, I see, you know, pointing and whispering at times, I think, you know, most of the negative types of things come from people who don't have much courage. I get thousands of emails, and the positive ones I can write back to.
Absolutely.
The ones who come with some sort of a slam, almost never can you write back. It comes back as undeliverable because they're hiding behind some false address, and that's the kind of spirit that provokes that kind of comment.
And you don't have time to put yourself in that kind of muck to get back and respond to them. You just got.
Well, you know, I've tried, you know, because for the sake of informing people, say, you know, look, you're misinformed. Here's where you can get the facts, but I'm not successful because they're hiding. So
And it a lot depends on how they approach you. I mean, I get a lot of emails questioning some of the things I do on this program. I get tremendous amounts of great email from people, but some of the other ones that come across is, you know, why do you do this or that? If it's done in a very approachable critique or
yeah,
or
what
question,
I call it honest skepticism. If a person
absolutely.
You know admits, look, I don't know, I don't have enough information. You know, this is the problem I have with this. Explain this to me. I can handle that just fine. And you know, that's why I enjoy you know the talks that I do at universities more so than say at UFO conventions, because I get that kind of intelligent. Skepticism that you know allows for a logical response, and so that's, you know, refreshing. Although, you know, by and large, I really don't enjoy talking about it that much.
Let's come back with phone calls, Travis. And also, was there any color to this UFO, to this craft?
Metallic.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. We'll open up the phone lines. This is an opportunity for you. Once in a lifetime. Travis, the book Fire in the Sky, did you write that in 1997? Was that after the movie?
Yeah, I wrote that after the movie. The original book, The Walton Experience, that the movie was supposedly based on, was written way back years before, 77, I believe. But Fire in the Sky, The Walton Experience, is really the first book in a much expanded, updated version.
The chances and the opportunities that you have when you walk outside, look up in the sky, do you still wonder, where do they come from?
Oh, yeah. You know, I try not to let it, you know, take over, but it's a feeling that never goes away, you know, that there's a lot we don't know, you know, I just have a big curiosity about it, but I've learned to temper my curiosity with caution.
Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us with Travis Walton. Hi there.
Is that me?
It sure is, sir. Go ahead. And where are you calling from?
Yeah, my name's Tim. I'm outside of Pittsburgh, PA.
Okay.
And I saw the movie a long time ago when it first came out, and I'll tell you what, when I was about probably 9 or 10, I think something happened to me that I still can't explain to this day. And I was just a kid playing hide and seek, and it was in the fall, and I took off and ran. We had a barn. I ran over by it. Next thing I knew, I saw this thing that was up above it, and it wasn't making any noise or anything. There were lights on it. And next thing I knew, I was running back, and I was out of there, and nobody that I was with knew anything about it or anything, couldn't see anything or remember or anything about it. It was just so strange, but it scared me, and my mother still remembered me running up there and telling her about it when I was just a kid. And after that, probably a few years, I was watching TV laying on the floor, and something Travis said right there a little while went right through me when he mentioned the people in the blue uniform. This guy had a real tight-fitting head-to-toe suit on with a visor that stuck out and a red lens on it. I looked over and caught it out of the corner of my eye while I was watching TV, and it just stood straight still and went right into the floor, right straight down, without moving. And I don't know, that when he said that about the blue uniform, went right through me. Has anybody ever said anything like that to him, or...
Do you get people that relate their own experiences to you, Travis?
Yeah, I do get a lot of that, you know, and they're intrigued by similarities between what they've experienced and what I've experienced.
Yeah. I don't know, it went right through me when you said that, and it just, I had to call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Tim. You know, in that movie, if I remember it, Travis, did the aliens or whoever they may be try to stick a needle into your eye, at least in the movie?
Well, they did it in the movie, but you know, I don't recall anything like that while I was conscious. Like I said, I looked at those instruments laying out there, and I you know, kind of still shudder to think what they might have been intending to do or might have done before I regained consciousness. But that was a pretty intense way for the movie to relate that apprehension I have about what they might have been doing to me.
West of the Rockies, you're up with Travis Walton on Coast to Coast.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Nancy, and I know somebody that Travis... First of all, it's an honor to speak to you, George, and to speak with Travis.
Well, thank you, Nancy.
Yeah. I know Alan Dallas, by the way. He, a couple of years ago, was driving a shuttle between Phoenix and Prescott. My parents live up in Prescott, and I was... I was the only person in the shuttle going back down from Prescott, and we talked for the whole two-hour trip about you and the story. And I have yet to read the book, but I did read your whole. I read every page that you allowed us to read on your website last night. And I just wanted to tell you that Dallas feels like he's still a friend. And he's adamant that this happened. He said it really happened. His whole family, you know, I mean, it changed his life profoundly. And he said the one thing about the movie that disturbed him was he was painted to be a bad guy.
Yeah, well, he was kind of a wild guy back then.
Oh, he was?
Like I said in the movie, in the book, you know, he's a likable guy, too, you know, in spite of the fact that... you know, we had a few abrasive moments, him with most of the guys on the crew at one time or another. But, you know, Alan has got his life lined out. He's not the wild guy he used to be. So, you know, he's a good guy.
Yeah, he seems like he would love to keep in touch if you were, you know, he admitted to losing touch with you or that you moved to another state or something. And, you know, he knows that you have six kids and that you moved to another state or something. And I used to vacation up in Heber, well, really Greer. My family went up to Greer and Alpine every summer. I'm a third-generation Arizonan. And I know the area very well that you're talking about, Snowflake, and I had some friends that lived in Snowflake. And also something that you mentioned, just a quick comment about the dinginess and the thickness of the air. I keep having a, well, my son and I saw a UFO that we saw, we've seen several actually in our lifetime, but I keep having this reoccurring memory about a very dingy clinic where it's very dim lights and it's not very clean. I mean, I remember waking up on some kind of a gurney or a table and seeing other women on gurneys beside me and, I kept thinking, well, what kind of a clinic would this be? It's not very clean. It's not very run very well, you know. But apparently the nurse who was wearing a surgical mask, but I knew she wasn't human, she said, well, you'll be having a baby in 2 hours. And I said, well, you know, I objected to that because I said, well, this baby's only 3 months old. It's not ready to be born. And I remember these memories are coming back, so... But the thing that went through me is the Nordic people that you're talking about, were they blonde? They're very tall and beautiful, right? Were they blonde, as far as you remember?
Yeah, well, you know, they weren't like platinum blonde hair, but they were, you know, a fair.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And then
same kind that you saw, Nancy?
I've had mental... I'm sorry that he did not... They finally answered some of my questions because... I just kept talking to them. I said, if I'm going to have a baby, who's the father? Because at that time, I did not have a boyfriend in my life. And finally, they pulled back a curtain in another cubicle or another room, and there was a guy sitting there. And I said, well, I don't know him from Adam. You know, and I was really upset that they were answering questions. And I was just I was being very direct with them, and I remember it being mental telepathy. And I also remember a nurse that looked very insect-like. She must have been about 7 feet tall and kind of had brown, leathery skin.
Ew, like a praying mantis?
She had a hump. Her uniform, she had a cloak, a white cloak, but it did not fit like a normal body. There was a big hump in the back. So, and then her face was very leathery and angular, and it's hard to say what she looked like under the mask. I would not want to know what she really looked like.
All right. Thanks for the stories. Appreciate that. Travis, any idea what the craft might have been doing in that area a long time ago?
Well, I don't know. You know, some people think they suggested, well, maybe they were having some sort of mechanical difficulty, you know, stop for repair. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe they were interested. Maybe there was some sort of study going on. Maybe some sort of mining or, you know, some of that. But I don't know. You know, it's kind of an unusual situation. You know, what could they be up to? What would they need to be so close to the ground for? A lot of questions. You know, people say, well, they were waiting beside the road for you to come by. But I don't think so, you know.
No, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That's what I like, yeah.
First-time caller, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Eli out of Corpus Christi.
Go ahead, Eli.
Hi. I was just wondering, the character Dallas that came out in Fire in the Sky, mm-hmm. I was just wondering if Travis and him really did have altercations where they were, where Dallas was there with the chainsaw, like, right in front of him, if they were really going through, like, arguments and stuff like that during the course that it took place.
Well, we had had some, you know, rough times in the past, you know. But, and, you know, Mike and him had been in a fist fight, but, you know, all that kind of stuff had been resolved. He, you know, the arguments come up at times, and, you know, he did nearly drop a tree on me, but...
just a tree, right?
Yeah. And, you know, whether that was intentional or not, you know, he was a hard worker, and sometimes he'd put his head down and cut and not watch, but... So it could have been an accident, but, you know, like I said in the book, I had my suspicions. I don't know. I think all that's behind us, but he was a little bit more the wildest of the bunch, you know, and he had been in some trouble before in his growing up years, and he was even in some trouble after that. But
tell me a logger who wasn't a toughie, huh?
Yeah, I guess that's the way. You had to be kind of hard to put up with the job. It was not
it's a tough job. No, not at all.
One
if anybody needs to email you, Travis, including Dallas, who may be listening, can they get to you through your website?
Yeah, there's a provision there where they can contact me through traviswalton.com.
All right, very good. Let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Caroline calling from Edmonton, Alberta.
Go ahead.
Hi, and it's such a pleasure to talk to you, Travis. Like, I had an experience. I grew up on the east coast of Canada in Nova Scotia. And in 1981, me and a friend of mine, we had been studying for exams, and she worked at a restaurant. And the restaurant was just across the street from where I lived. And she had just closed up, and we were both out on the front step of this restaurant, and we both happened to look up, and this huge, if I were to compare it to a 747, it would have been really, really close, but there was no telling how close this thing was. There was no wings. It was cigar-shaped. And I just remember we looked at each other, and we ran, and this was about, like, probably around 11, between 11 and a quarter after 11.
Was there sound?
No, it was the silence. It was like almost like a shh, like just like not even a hissing. It's just like as it was going over, it was the silence is what caught us. And the thing is, like, I went running, she went running, and I didn't get home till like 10 to 4 in the morning. And, like, I remember getting in big doo-doo over that, but all I remember is running home, which was less than 100 feet, around 11 o'clock at night, and only getting home at 10 to 4 in the morning. And I don't, like, I don't know if I went nuts or what had happened, but I don't recall being on, like, being abducted or anything like that. I just have this loss of time. But right immediately, like, after that, like, within probably a week, I developed psoriasis over my body. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that was long-lasting, like, physically, on your body, or as far as that
well, you
goes.
Know, right in the aftermath, I did have you know a tremendous amount of stress that I was undergoing, and I did develop some, you know, I had trouble sleeping, and so I had some skin rashes that eventually went away, but I think it was just stress related.
Did you have any major mark where that beam might have hit you in the chest?
No, I did have upper body x-rays that showed no sort of broken bones or damaged structures, and basically I've been, you know, unusually healthy, you know, in my life. I
I was going to say, do you catch colds, Travis, or anything like that?
Well, I haven't lost a day of work in...
Since this happened?
Years and years, you know. There'll be occasionally I'll get a little bit of a... It never hits me as hard as anybody else. I just, you know, it just never really... It actually makes me sick. It just starts and then it's gone.
Did you go back to logging once you showed up again?
I did return to work in the woods for some time after that. It was hard getting back, and I was a little bit nervous about that. But, heck, even after enough years, I went back to where I was working by myself at times. But I didn't like being out there late in the evening or at night.
No. Did you look over your shoulder a lot?
Yeah, I definitely did.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing there, Mr. Gordon?
Good.
How are you?
Thank you, sir.
How you doing there, Mr. Travis Walton?
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity for the call from Council of Iowa. My name is Ricky. I have a question for Mr. Travis.
Were you
telepathically, physically levitated or a particle beamed up to the vessel or craft?
Well, I was unconscious during the time I was taken aboard, so I don't know how they accomplished that. The men and the sheriff's department searched the ground, and they didn't find any unusual tracks. So I just don't know how they accomplished that.
I see. So, a while back you talked about like crop formations, or so there was nothing on the ground that would have like a circular or an indentation of platform or anything like
if
that.
You'll notice on the movie in the end credits, there's a credit for the Geiger counter man. That was a scene that was filmed that was left out of the movie. This is about an incident that really happened during the search. But apparently the script, they were trying to build the question in the audience's mind, did this happen or is this just something the crew's putting forward? So they didn't want that kind of evidence being brought forward. But there was a lot of positive evidence that the movie didn't deal with, and that those Geiger counter readings were one of them. There were some other researchers that came on during the search that found unusual magnetic readings in the area. And like I described earlier, the changes in the growth of that vegetation right around there.
There weren't any
burn marks or any circular impressions or anything like that. The ground wasn't really covered with grass that much. You know, it was mostly either bare rock or pine needles.
Did anybody report seeing lights on that day in November 1975 in that region?
Oh, wow. A lot of people. You know, it's amazing over the years how many people have contacted me that have been in the area at that time that did see, you know, an object pass overhead, or, there were deer hunters and a lot of people out. And it's surprising how many people have seen things at that particular time.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Max in California.
Hi, Max. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's going to be another movie that would be more true to his experience.
Hmm. Okay, any updates here, Travis, or do you think
there was a group that was trying to get funding to buy the movie and reshoot the ending, and that would be a dream of mine, but I kind of doubt that's going to happen. But it would be neat to see the story told as it really happened. And one thing I should interject here is that the scriptwriter, the screenwriter, made me promises about staying true to the story. And he did his best. There was quite a battle that he had because, you know, once he signed with a development deal with the studio, his power was greatly reduced to the point where he was unable to keep certain changes from being made. And although he did his best, and so...
How did it do at the box office, Travis?
Pardon?
Oh, how did it do at the box office?
It was the number one movie in the country at the time, but... I don't know if you remember, back then there was what they called the snowstorm of the century, that the opening weekend shut down the entire third of the United States.
I remember that. Stay with us. We'll wrap Travis Walton, the rest of your calls. Travis, do you go to colleges very often then to make speeches?
Oh, I have at various ones, and that they're probably a minority of the appearances I make, but I probably ought to do more of those if I'm going to do them at all. It is something that I've toyed with, the idea of just retiring from this whole thing and not talking about it anymore at all.
Well, that's true, too. Back to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going east of the Rockies. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hey, this is Dave in Panama City Beach, Florida. How you guys doing,
Dave,
this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Working my lonely outpost here on Midnight by myself. Thanks for the company. I just had a question for Travis. When he was on board, did he see any kind of gauges or writings or symbols, anything, you know, on you know, instruments, anything that would, you know, show any kind of script that they had?
I didn't see any writing. There was a screen with some geometric things. But they weren't like symbols, or it was more like a grid, angles and grids, rather than characters like letters or numbers or anything.
Oh, I was just curious. One other question for you.
Sure.
Do you have to work tomorrow? This is kind of late.
Yep. I got to be there at 6.
Thanks a lot, sir.
Yeah.
We all have our crosses to bear, Travis.
Yep, we do.
Let's. When you were in the craft, were you bolted down, strapped down, or did you just kind of, you know, were you just lying there on a cot or something?
Well, they had some kind of a device lying across my chest, but it wasn't heavy enough to hold me down. And when I, you know, sat up, it fell off. So I guess the only thing that was holding me down was the fact that I was unconscious.
Wild card line, you're up with Travis Walton. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, my name is Mike Roy. I'm calling from Austin, Texas.
Sure.
I had a question about on the movie. The movie seemed to portray the aliens as kind of mean, kind of hostile. I was wondering, was that any part true?
Well, they changed the appearance of the aliens quite a bit. They were naked in the movie. In actuality, they wore coveralls.
Uh-huh. Was the skin like that too? They looked like they were kind of tannish looking.
Yeah, they changed the color some. Uh-huh. And, you know, they had these little eyes in the movie, whereas
right.
You know, they were much larger than that. I think their one concession to that was when the actor finds these suits, space suits, that the aliens had been wearing, they had very large eyes that were more of the typical gray look that is reported nowadays.
But were they, did they seem to be like they were that mean, or?
No, you know, like I said, you know, the fact that I was in such pain and having trouble breathing led me to have a very negative reaction just to the sight of them. But
yeah, I imagine.
In retrospect, you know, I can't say that the pain was coming from them, and it was just more of a gut reaction rather than any sort of a reasoned response.
Huh. Well, I was just curious. I didn't know how much they had altered it, or
yeah, they changed
from the story.
It quite a bit. You know, the real story's in the book. The movie gives the feel, but if you want the facts, that's in the book. And I'm not trying to sell books because I don't have any. But you can go to a library and check it out.
You know, as a matter of fact, Fire in the Sky, when you wrote it, wonderful book, good ratings. It is available on Amazon.com, right?
It's a used book. I hear you're getting pretty pricey these days, but I hope to have a new supply, and if people would like to be notified when that becomes available, they can contact me at the website.
Very good. First-time caller line, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi, Travis. Hi, George.
Hello there.
A lot of these abduction cases seem to have a large spiritual, sort of metaphysical aspect to them. Do you think this was an entirely physical abduction, or do you feel there was some sort of spiritual kind of component to it?
Well, you know, this incident affected my entire life in the most profound way on every level. You know, physical, spiritual, psychological, you know, you name it. And it's, you know, I could go all night on all those areas, and I tried to do that in the book, but some of it's personal. It's pretty deep, and you know, I'm a philosophical person, and so I've done a lot of thinking about this and trying to get some meaning from it all.
Okay, thanks for your call. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Travis.
Good morning.
This is Mark in Newport. I just had a couple quick questions. I was wondering if you've done any checks for implants, because a lot of people that have been abducted have talked about that. And also, have you had any missing time? I've got to get back to work, so I'll listen off the air.
Okay, implants and missing time, Travis.
Well, I did have upper body x-rays, and they didn't see anything there. And they wanted to x-ray my head, but I was leery about that. I didn't feel there was anything there. You know, x-rays aren't exactly the thing to do just on a fishing expedition, so I don't know. I haven't noticed any unusual lumps or anything like that. See, what was the other part of the question?
He also wanted to know about implants, of course, and which you just answered. And it's lost me too. He buzzed by so fast; it's gone. That's all right. Wild card line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Patty from Mid Missouri. And my question for Mr. Walton is, and you are truly a hero and like this, but my question really quick, just because I know we don't have much time, is do you think that you had any type of medical issue before this incident happened? Because I had a friend who had a brain aneurysm that was going to explode, which he didn't know until after his encounter. And basically, he attributes the aliens to saving his life.
Well, I don't know. I had some pretty extensive examinations. As a matter of fact, I even had an EEG, I still have the report. It describes, a little bit of an anomaly, let me see if I can remember the wording now, a bisynchronous wave traveling from front to back. Technician says he didn't know of any particular significance to this anomaly, and or something to words to that effect, but you know, nothing like that would suggest that there was some great trauma to the brain or anything like that.
Yeah, because it wrecked it. They told him that there was a lot of scar tissue when they took him in, because they did find him unconscious. We drive paper routes together, and they found him unconscious, and they took him into the hospital, and they did a lot of extensive stuff, and that's what they found out, that there was brand new scar tissue near the base of his neck, where it appears as though he had a rather large embolism that would have probably, they said it would have had to explode, but there was so much scar tissue it looked like it had been lasered over, but he had never had any treatment for it or anything, didn't know anything about it.
Well, that's
so
interesting.
He remembers the pain like you do and all that. But like you, he doesn't attribute that pain really to what they were doing. It may have been at the time that this was ready to explode, and he happened to be in the right place at the right time. And he attributes to them saving his life.
Yeah, well, you know, I did have some misgivings in the aftermath of this, that the incident might have left me with, some residual damage of some sort. But none of that's become evident. I've been pretty healthy, so I think I've been dodged a bullet there.
Did you ever come away with any theories at all, Travis, about what the heck this might all be about?
Well, you know, their visits or what their intentions are is you know, I don't know. I've had a lot of people come to me and say, I have all the answers and here it is. But I haven't really, you know, found anything that truly, you know, ties it all together for me. It's just so much of what I experienced is like a fragment of something more, and I may never know.
The other part two question was missing time from a couple of callers.
Oh, missing time. Well, you know, I was returned with a memory of a conscious period of probably less than an hour, and I was missing for over 5 days and 6 hours, so I guess that would qualify as missing time. Other than that, you know, I don't have anything to report.
Okay, a couple more minutes left, so let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, my name is Karen. I'm calling from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. Hi, Travis. It's so cool talking to you. I'm just amazed. That's awesome. I wanted to know about your lost time, and just, would you want to know what happened to you? Do you want to know?
Well, it's Pandora's box, you know. something, if, you know, say I was to spontaneously recover a bunch of memories, it might be very gratifying to me to know what happened, but I might have a lot of second thoughts about going public with it because of the incredible reaction that I've already had to endure, and, you know, it's just something I might do, keep to myself if it were to happen.
Oh, well, I just really admire your strength. I'm terrified of aliens, and I think it's a phobia, and I just really admire your strength, telling your whole story and everything that you've had to endure. So thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, thank you.
I guess you, Travis, do not scoff at anyone who claims that they were taken, abducted, do you?
No. You know, without investigating, that would be unfair, you know, because, you know, some people sound very much more credible than others, but, you know, I'm not going to pass judgment on anybody because... I know that the unusual does sometimes occur.
Let's pick it up by going to our wild card line. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Good morning, George.
Hi.
Good morning, Travis. This is Greg calling you from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And, George, you have a way with words. It's a deed and honor to speak to Travis in a lifetime opportunity, so I'll be brief. Did you ever, your breathing ever get improved as you were on there, because you stated that you felt like you were claustrophobic, and like in the movie, they had cold, your breath could be seen. Was it cold or hot on the ship?
Well, when I woke up, that atmosphere right there was extremely hard to breathe, or at least my medical symptoms were that way. I was struggling to breathe. It seemed very muggy, humid, hard to breathe and hot and humid. But when I was taken outside of that craft into this larger area, it seemed very much easier to breathe, and it was cooler. And there was a sort of a breathing anomaly that was noticed by investigators in the you know, weeks and months after this, even years, that I would at times, when at rest, just sort of stop breathing for a few seconds here and there. And it's just, I think it's just sort of an artifact of being in a highly conditioned state. You know, that was very hard work in those days, going up steep inclines at high altitude. And your respiratory system gets so highly conditioned that, you know, it's easy to get too much air. So, you know, you just skip a breath here and there when you're at rest, but other than that, you know, there was no, you know, aftermath of anything having to do with breathing them.
I too want to applaud your courage in telling your truth, because I admire that.
Well, you know, people keep saying stuff like that, but all I've done is just try to cope with a bad situation. I didn't ask for it, and I've just had to, you know, make the best of the situation. So, you know, I don't think that I've done anything extraordinary. What happened to me was certainly extraordinary, but all I've done is cope.
What do the experts say about the polygraph tests and that all of you passed it, Travis? Do they say whatever they're saying is true, or do they say whatever they think they saw is true?
Well, you know, whatever they think they saw is the most they could say, because, you know, all the polygraph measures is what people believe. And so, in all fairness, I have to, you know, say that, you know, they just say that we believe this happened. But that's true of anybody in any situation that ever takes a polygraph test. But the experts have said, you know, all of the tests that were given to 9 of the people involved, that many people passing tests on the same issue, the chances of there being any sort of, you know, false reading or anything are over 1,000,000 to 1. And so, you know, it's pretty conclusive, especially when you have that many people, you know, taking that many tests. And some of us have been retested, you know. Mike, the crew boss, Alan Dallas, and myself were retested during the about the time the movie was coming out.
All passed again.
The most modern equipment that they had available at the time, much updated and refined techniques. And all of us passed at the highest levels of believability.
Is there any chance that you might have been picked up by some government experiment and that whatever they did was so good that all of you are thinking in the same terms, but that there was some other purpose here, some kind of a experiment.
I've speculated about that myself, you know, even in the book, you know, that what if our government, with their trillions of dollars in black budget to spend however they want, you know, simulated something for their own purposes that led us to believe that this happened. And, you know, that's a possibility. And I see nothing about it that I could conclusively say that was the case or wasn't the case, because, you know, if they were good enough, they could fool us. But we do know that what we saw and what we experienced was for real.
Wildcard Line, you're on with Travis Walton on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Is that me?
Yes, sir.
How you doing? You guys are great. I appreciate the opportunity. I became a somewhat serious researcher about 15 years ago. Got sucked into it by Bob Lazar and John Lear, and been calling the show for a long time. Talked to Art a lot and discussed Travis's case quite a bit. And it really is one of the most credible aspects of the whole UFO question. I particularly appreciate Travis's humble spirit that he brings to it and his openness.
Absolutely.
You know, with all these great scientific minds that, you know, as Stanton Friedman says, you know, they've all come to the conclusion that you can't get here from there, you know. But, you know, who's to say, you know, millions of years of research and all. I do have a couple of questions, though, and I want to get to them. I could talk to you for hours, Travis. You're a fascinating person, and you've become a pretty good speaker. I hope you'll stay in touch with everybody. You're a very likable person.
And oh, thank you.
I hope you're making some money off of this. Why not? I mean, geez,
No, that's not the case.
I know they accuse you. You know, they accuse everybody of, you know, well, you got some motive, and you're the one person of all of them, you know, that has never been that way. But, you know, heck with them. Make some money. Anyway, let me get to these questions. First of all, in the beginning, when you first come to on the ship in the movie, you're kind of in this honeycomb thing, this gooey honeycomb with all these dead bodies around you. It's a very morbid scene. Explain to me if that was real at all. And then the other thing, let me get the questions out and then you can answer.
Well, because we only got about 40 seconds left.
Okay, the other thing is, once you gain consciousness again, you know, and then next thing we know, you're back at Earth. Did you go back to sleep, or what happened from the time you gained consciousness until the time that you, you know, were...
All right, let's let him answer. Go ahead,
okay,
Travis.
None of that gooey stuff, none of that stuff happened. That was just Hollywood's little creativity. And I was rendered unconscious. I was actually forced onto a table and a mask placed over my face, some sort of gas probably that rendered me unconscious. And I was deposited back on the road unconscious.
Travis, it's been a delight talking with you. And let me tell you something. And for someone who investigates this field like I have so many years, you are an absolute precious delight just to talk to. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, George.
Travis Walton. TravisWalton.com is his website, the book, Fire in the Sky. I'm telling you, you just listen to history.